When Ford reintroduced the Ford Bronco in 2020, it was bringing back iconic Americana to a nostalgia-hungry public looking for their next SUV. From its base model with standard four-wheel drive and removable doors to posh trims that included stuff like LED lighting and heated seats, the relaunched vehicle had six trim levels to service the needs of everyone from serious off-roaders to suburban families. But Ford's claim that it was resurrecting the first American SUV perhaps went too far. The current Bronco, like the first generation, was clearly inspired by a vehicle created by a farm machinery company 6 years prior to the birth of the original. That vehicle was the International Harvester Scout. The Scout was a pioneer in the off-road SUV segment and established the concept of adding a side of luxury to the meat and potatoes sport utility vehicle. So, how did International Harvester start America's love affair with the SUV? How did they get there from making plows and threshers? And why, after a huge run of success, did they fall off the map? Well, today on Pass Gas, we're going to find out. It's the history of International Harvester.
Canyonero.
Pass Gas Podcast. It's about cars, it's not about forts.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Pass Gas. We're feeling goofy today.
We're a little off today because we had James May on the Big Three right before this, and he made us drink a bunch of gin. He's making gin right now. Check it out, James May.
He's making gin right now.
Check it out right now.
He made us drink that, and I drank a nice little.
Yeah,
one
of them was called Navy strength, and it was 57% alcohol.
Pretty good. So, my name is Nolan Sykes, joined as always by Joe Weber.
Hey, you don't know me.
What?
You don't know me.
And joining us, that laugh you hear across from me for the first time ever on Past Gas, please welcome to the show, Bart Bidlingmeyer. Yeah.
I didn't explain. You don't have to clap. Trust me, by the end of this, you're going to regret it. Oh.
Bart, how's it going, man?
Good, thanks. Really excited for, listened and watched a long time and happy to be on the Joe Weber Experience. This is going to be great.
You don't know me.
I'm really stoked to have you here. This is going to be going to be fun. Do you have any prior, do you have any, let's see.
On-camera experience?
Yeah. No. Yeah, we're actually interviewing for the first time on the show live.
What are your goals?
Yeah.
What's your 10-year plan? Do you have any just cherished memories of the International Scout? Have you ever?
So when I was at Motor Trend, we did a pilot with the Holden brothers who put together, it was a really low buck, really smart build. Mm-hmm. And that got a show picked up for us, got it greenlit. But
that was a Scout?
It was a Scout, cool. Yeah. And it was, they, you know, did a great job. It was real quick. They got rid of the rust. And the I think the thing people love about those, the Scouts particular, but also just that era of car, is that it's a machine, and mm-hmm. all you got to do is make sure everything's connected.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And they run.
It seems just like farming machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Like kind of just this bucket with wheels and stuff.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Joe? Any memories? Anybody?
No, but there is.
In your life?
There's a Scout Club of something like really close to my house.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of rich guys fixed them up. I was like, I wonder if I could afford one. No way. They're like basically start at like 30,000, 50,000.
There's a guy at the end of my street who's got a nice old Scout. And then as I was kind of, you know, it's just a machine you admire. Like, oh, those look good. Yeah. Those are good. And then I drove by one time and he's got a second, like, donor Scout. I was like, this guy's.
There you go. Our boy Eddie has a Scout.
I didn't know that.
Drive, yeah.
I think he bought it after Runs Good.
Oh, did he? I wonder if he got, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. He also bought the S10, what is it?
C10.
C10. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a monster.
Yeah. I mean, you got a good deal on it.
When I was at Motor Trend, we had a show called Runs Good. It's on Max right now.
Can, check it out. It's fun. It's got our guy Danger Dan in it.
Yeah, Dan's in it. Shay Seafelt and Aaron Parker.
My man. Hell yeah.
They did good stuff. It was a fun show.
My scout story is that my boy Brandon
Nobody asked. Let's get on with the story.
My boy Brandon Simonini had one in high school. It was a open top with like a roll bar and stuff. And what we would do, we'd pile in the back of that thing with our longboards and shortboards, go down to San Luis Obispo.
I remember when you first started working at when I first started working at Donut, you were like, man, there are a lot of like trick skateboarders that work here. And I was like, you don't get to retroactively call us a different name because you have a longboard.
Yes, but I ask you, Joe Weber, noted disc golf enthusiast. What do you call golfers?
Ball golf.
That's right.
Disc golf. I didn't know that. Is that a thing? Do disc golfers?
No, it's golfers? Just okay. A funny
it's
thing.
It's a joke.
That we do.
That's pretty good.
But I think some people do take it.
Do you
seriously.
Call? Will you just call?
No, disc, he doesn't.
Is part of the bit
golf.
Just calling disc golf golf?
Yeah.
Let's go golf.
Not ball golf.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Golf golf. No, but we'd go and take his not Bronco. His scout down to Slo to the parking garages, tear those up on our longboards and our helmets.
Oh, cool. Did you have
I made my own out of like some gloves I got from Kmart and a cutting board that I sawed together and hot glued there. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Anyway, that's my story. And I think he's.
How long have you been sitting on that story?
Yeah, just, Brandon Simonini.
Like my boy Simo. I mean, a long time.
Because I like the way you were like,
hey, let me
I bet if I
up.
Ask Bart and Joe.
Hey, you know, Simo,
ask everybody what their connections to this story. What
really
they know
itching
anything.
To bring up Simonini in one of these
I do,
episodes.
I miss him. I miss Simo. Okay. So with that out of the way, now we know. Everybody's...
Yeah.
Some people have a tenuous kind of relationship, like not
sure.
threadbare. Like
I will say, after editing this script, I really fell in love with these again, and they sold a shit ton of them. So they should be
really.
You should be able to find a pretty cheap one. They sold maybe 10 times as many as the Bronco sold, like the first Bronco.
That's news.
Is that simply because it was earlier? It's just a product of how long it was out before there was a competitor.
From what we'll get into, Ford didn't really market the Bronco that much. It was kind of an afterthought, and they were like testing a new market. And so the Bronco now is like a huge thing.
Yeah. Well, let's get into it.
All right. Yeah. Hey, awesome. Yes, let's. International Harvester, as a company, started as a merger between two powerhouses of the farming industry, battling it out in the same city, Bart. There was McCormick Harvesting, named after the founder Cyrus Hall McCormick.
I love their nutmeg.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, a fine spice maker.
Were you going to say nutmeg or?
No, I was just going to say spice in general.
Oh, okay.
You got nutmeg on the mind.
And they had started making Reapers back in 1831. Nice.
Also a pepper.
Hey. Reaper pepper, nice.
Then there's McCormick's competition, Deering Harvester, founded by William Deering. Both companies were responsible for the lion's share of the market at that time, and in 1902, a compromise was brokered. The two merged to form International Harvester. The merger also included three smaller companies. There is Plano Manufacturing Company, the Milwaukee Harvester Company, Joe, and Warder, Bushnell, and Glessner.
I'm more of a Warder, Bushnell, and Glessner guy than a Milwaukee Thresher.
When all was said and done, the new entity controlled 85% of the domestic market for harvesting machinery. That seems like a freaking monopoly or something.
Yeah,
huh?
But it's like, it's a very specific
still, dude.
Industry.
Yeah.
They'll screw
85%.
You.
I found out that Chicago became, this is all in Chicago, by the way.
That's why we brought Bart on.
Oh, you lived in Chicago.
I did live in Chicago for a while when I was making tractors.
There's a reason someone on Reddit was like, why is the west coast of Lake Michigan all built up but not the east coast? It's because it's not only the gateway to like the Mississippi, but also because of pigs in like specifically pigs in Chicago.
Okay.
Pigs were like a huge industry, but then because that was such a big industry.
I thought that was Cincinnati.
You're thinking of the Skyline Chili.
No, in Cincinnati, there was the streets used to run red with blood.
From pig blood?
They slaughtered so many pigs. Yeah, it's called Porkopolis, but please. Please, come on.
Well, I guess this was like a sister pig city.
Okay.
But yeah, the pigs brought agriculture industry, which brought other stuff. And, you know, the workers had to drink, so they brought breweries or whatever. But Milwaukee was bigger than Chicago for a while, and we still hold it over their heads.
Cool. In 1907, with Cyrus McCormick Jr. at the helm, International Harvester took a detour from the field and solved a problem that had long plagued farmers in rural areas, getting goods from farm to market. International Harvester produced a vehicle that combined high ground clearance with a bed that could carry equipment, people, or anything else. This design and functionality made the Model A auto wagon the very first pickup truck. It came with a then powerful 15 horsepower engine, and it was a huge success. 2 years later, IH had become the fourth largest industrial company in America.
That is a truck.
Yeah, it looks like the old fire trucks.
It looks like what the original Suburban kind of
the Suburban carry.
Oh, yeah. I see. Yeah, covered.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
On like 36 inch wheels there. Crazy.
That's what you guys should put on the Miata, is wooden wheels.
We did.
We put Model A.
Yeah, Model A wheels.
Wheels on it. And it was horrible. It was really scary.
In 1915, this segment had further matured. The industrial segment had further matured. And IH was making five different truck models. These included smaller, light-duty vehicles to help on the farm and heavy-duty vehicles that could be customized for various purposes, including firefighting. Of course, right around the corner was World War I. This devastating conflict would lead to a huge ramp-up of truck production, and once over, Americans would eagerly take on the surplus of the truck supply. Utilitarian and modification-friendly, the popularity of trucks would only continue to rise.
What's your favorite Dub-Dub-1 battle?
I'm not much of a historian. I can tell you how it started, but...
Nolan.
I can't even name... The Somme, that's a battle.
The Somme.
That's the only one I know, really.
Was the Bulge?
That was World War II.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's all you talk about is the Bulge. I also think it's something we should also just think about is that the product, let's say, that International Harvester is competing with right now is a horse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? And they're like, you know...
And it's,
we got these in
the- apropos that they started battling against the Bronco later.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Back to the Bulge.
So, in 1917, International Harvester was larger than all of its competitors combined and a whopping four times larger than John Deere. But its farm machinery was facing competition from the same new technology that powered their trucks, the internal combustion engine. The Ford Motor Company entered the farm space with the Fordson, a light-duty tractor that, like its Model T, was inexpensive to own and operate. The Fordson immediately became a market leader, and in 1920 alone, Ford sold 67,000 of those tractors. To ensure its continued dominance, Ford slashed prices to undercut their competition. This sent other manufacturers out of business and sent a strong message to International Harvester that they would need to compete with Ford on something other than price. Work began at IH to make a tractor that excelled where the Fordson lagged. They correctly identified that their competition was not just the Fordson, which could plow, but from horses that were still used in crop cultivation. Dude, you nailed it, Bart.
Well, I'm something of a car historian.
In 1923, their efforts culminated in the Farmall, an all-purpose tractor and the world's first row crop tractor.
Do you guys have any Farmall stories?
Yeah.
What's your first memory of the Farmall?
No, I was pulling a Nolan. I was keying that up. My grandfather had a Farmall.
He did?
Yeah. And they had some land in Cincinnati, like kind of, you know, outside the city, of course, because you have a tractor, but...
Whoa. Earthquake.
It's still going.
Whoa.
We're on a fault line.
We are being shook.
No, this building.
Yeah.
It's on a...
Wait. Right beneath us.
It's still going.
It's still going. Do you feel that?
I don't feel it, but I can see the
I felt it in my butt.
Whoa, everyone's going crazy in the lunchroom right now.
Yeah. Is there a fart line here?
A fart line?
There's a fart line. It's your butt crack. But anyways. Oh,
yeah. I knew we got you on for a reason.
he had a bright red Farmall tractor, and we used to ride on the back.
With your longboards?
With our longboards. We'd all pile in the back. And I actually had these gloves I made from a cutting board. No, but there was a big, it was just for mowing the lawn, this huge attachment with the blades behind it. And we would sit, and it's like thinking back, like if one of us had like let go of the, just fallen, we'd have been torn to shreds.
God.
Yeah. But it didn't happen.
Good time.
It's like when you see pictures of those baby cages that hang out of windows. You're like, yes. What were they thinking?
You never seen like, those?
No.
An attachment you put in your,
and it's like high rise.
Yeah, high rise like apartment windows.
Yeah.
And there's like a cage. Baby.
like outside of, yeah.
Your baby needs vitamin D.
That's great.
I'm having a drink. I'm putting the baby out the window. I need a drink.
He's getting his air.
Yeah. And then soon enough, Eric Clapton writes a song.
Jesus Christ. The Farmall debuted with two large wheels in the rear, which allowed for high ground clearance, and two tightly spaced smaller wheels in the front. This design, like Coca-Cola's Santa Claus, is the quintessential visual that people conjure up when imagining a tractor.
Is that where the Santa we know came from?
Coca-Cola?
Yeah. Are they pushing that on us?
Probably. I wouldn't doubt that it's a marketing scheme.
What's their angle here?
But it also to what you're saying is the way the wheels are spaced, the two in the front and the two large ones in the back, also let you could go over the rows where things were planted without disturbing them. So
that's
that was
smart.
A big yeah.
Damn. Yeah.
Holy
the
shit.
Santa I know is Middle Eastern.
it's where you're raised. So,
by 1930, IH had sold over 100,000 Farmalls.
The Santa I know is Midwestern.
And they had captured 44% of the tractor market, more than twice the share of John Deere. A redesign in 1939 led to the Farmall's Letter series and even more iconic models. Richard Lowry, the French-American product designer behind the Exxon logo, numerous Studebaker models, and Coke bottles, gave the Farmall more streamlined styling. This guy's got range. The success was staggering. Between 1939...
Like Eddie Redmayne of Farmall.
Between 1939 and 1953, nearly 392,000 Farmall H's were produced, the largest number of a single tractor model ever built.
That is a lot of tractors.
Yeah. I didn't know that Farmall was an International Harvester subbrand. I just always thought it was its own thing.
Oh, yeah. This is a tractor right here, people. Yeah. Yeah.
The iconic tractor.
This is the, it is the platonic ideal.
My question.
I took Philosophy 101.
Why has it always been the worst seat ever? Like, that is just like the worst.
The metal seat that's not shaped for a human butt.
Maybe not your butt.
No, it's not. My butt does not look like that. It's round and
I don't know why that is. Firm. I think
like let's just make a seat that we can stamp in the same line that we make trash cans in.
Yeah, pretty much. You can put a little pillow, a little donut under there. You know?
Yeah, a little hemorrhoid pillow.
Yeah, you're good to go. We'll be right back after this. While this was going on, while the Farmall stuff was going down, International Harvester continued their light truck production in the 1940s with their K-Series, which came in 42 different models and 142 wheelbase lengths. What?
When was the Suburban Carryall? Was that 35?
I think that was mid-to-late 30s, yeah.
Because
That's the longest-running badge of any car. But 142 different wheelbase lengths.
Yeah. Like, what is the point of that?
Is that just basically one every inch?
Yeah.
I like it's also
mind blowing.
This was nothing compared to the innovation they would bring to post-war America.
But it's like, is 142 different wheelbase lengths innovation? Or is that, it just seems silly to
me. It's the same way how like James Cameron went in and drew a money sign on Aliens. You're just adding one line to it.
And it's like, that was one guy's job. Jim, what do you got for me?
178
What if
inches.
We move it? An inch. Oh, print it. Just every time we could move the wheelbase an inch.
Genius.
God damn it, Jim, you're golden.
Similar to how World War I's surplus of trucks played a significant role in America's love affair with the truck, the Jeeps of World War II would give rise to America's equally steamy romance with sport utility vehicles.
Yeah, I wrote steamy. I had steamy, comma, creamy romance, but I had to edit it for time.
Yeah, I think we're on target.
Veterans came home to a country that would soon begin a massive investment in its roads and infrastructure, culminating in 1956's Federal Aid Highway Act. Getting outdoors was becoming easier than ever, and a burgeoning interest in camping led to attendance at U.S. national parks more than tripling from 1940 to 1956. Wow. What I love about this time in history is that Americans also didn't like exercising, right? They were just like, go to work and then go home.
Eat a steak.
And didn't
drink
really
some
have
whiskey.
Hobbies. Or they thought jogging was weird, right?
Sure.
It was not like, jogging was not a thing back then.
I know, but like, I know, but I'm just thinking about the
I know,
time
I want, let him, I want to know where this is going.
I just
going.
Think it's hilarious that they're like, hey, what if we actually like went outside? Wouldn't that be cool? Oh, yeah, I guess so.
I just always think of that Mad Men episode where they have a picnic and then throw all their trash and then just get in their car and leave. All right, I'm done with the outdoors.
Well, this is, it's like they've evolved now. It's they've progressed rather from putting your baby outside the window to taking them with you to the national parks.
Yes.
It's the natural progression.
The environment, coupled with returning GIs longing for the Willis Jeep they used during the war.
Willis.
Isn't it
Willis?
Willis.
It's Willis?
It's Willis.
Who's telling you? I've always said it was
Willis.
I've heard. I've since learned it's Willis.
Who told you that? The guy from Different Strokes?
No.
That was an old
Damn
show.
It. I don't know.
Where one of the guys' name was Willis.
Oh. Audrey's Jeep-obsessed friends back home say Willis.
Willis. All right. What you talking about, Willis?
You come on this show, you tell me.
We can edit it out. No, we can edit, we'll bleep it.
No, anytime, leave it in.
Anytime someone says Willies, we'll bleep it.
Yeah.
So they'll
Willis. Yeah.
You should get one clean to put over it. Willis. We're going to get a clean
Will.
So it'll always go. And then when it plays back, it's going to be, we're going to be talking, everyone says Willis the whole time. And be like, why do they keep correcting each other to Willis. Say Willis when they're already saying Willis?
That's a good bit. And definitely an efficient use of Gavin's time. So, after the war, Jeep began producing a CJ. Or civilian Jeep in 1944. I never knew that. I never put the pieces on it together on that.
I didn't either.
The heck?
Well, I was still pronouncing it Willie, so how would I know about this civilian Jeep?
However, this vehicle was about as stripped down as it gets, lacking in both seating and storage, almost as bare bones utilitarian as the Army issue version. At the other end of the size spectrum was the Chevy Suburban, generally considered to be the first full-size SUV. It began production in 1935. And is the longest continually produced auto nameplate in American history.
It's almost like I read this before.
However, with its expertise in the truck space, International Harvester had a direct competitor to the Chevy Suburban in 1953 with the IH Travelall, a large four-door, 4-to-5-seater.
That's fun. It's like when you cram somebody in the middle of the back seat. That's what that 4-to-5 was.
Yeah.
Just shoehorn someone in the middle.
Either like an old grandma. That's got.
You guys have any stories about your grandma you like?
Oh, I have a funny one.
Oh.
Wyatt's grandma is staying with us right now. And she
your
does
son.
This thing. My son. And she does this really funny thing when the baby's crying really hard. She'll go, "Is mama pinching you?" And I think it's hilarious. Emily hates it because she's like, no, I would never pinch him. It's like, that's the joke. But anyways, that's my grandma's story.
Okay.
It's such a good grandma thing.
Targeted at the full-size station wagon consumer, the Travel All stood out because it was based on a truck chassis and later featured four-wheel drive, another amenity that its station wagon competitors lacked because they sucked. In 1957, International Harvester debuted the Travelette, a proto full-size crew cab truck.
Proto full-size.
The Travelette took the stretch cab from the Travel All, offered a third door on the passenger side, and had room for up to six people. 2 years later, IH added the fourth door, creating the first ever four-door truck. These enhancements, plus the success of the Travel All, gave International Harvester the confidence that it could directly compete with the Jeep CJ and create a vehicle that was more accessible than the standard military-grade stuff. Enter the International Harvester Scout.
Nice. That's crazy that it was the first four-door truck.
Yeah, that's like, kind of weird. They also... On like
those things are these are sick as hell.
Yeah, the Travelall or the Travelette. Travelette. The Travelette was actually the first truck to have angry eyebrows on the headlights. So
dude, from the
Jeep guys can thank them.
That's so cool. That's nice.
That's really cool.
Yeah. I wonder if these are super
find
expensive.
One. Go on Craigslist.
Probably.
Ooh,
those
one.
Are probably pretty hard to find if I had a.
Oh, that's how I bring a trailer. Guess. What's it going for?
Is that the yellow one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, 56,000. Not bad.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I can see that. It looks.
Well, I gotta get Mike and Avery up in Rust Valley to find me one of these. Ah, Mike, I got beat on the face by a spider.
The Scout originally began its development as a compact pickup truck. However, things changed in 1959 when Ted Ornas, chief designer at International Harvester, was given a unique directive. Design something to replace the horse. In 1959?
Yeah, he's like, yeah, cars. Yeah. Done.
Yeah.
Easiest buck I ever made.
Trains?
The company's leaders wanted a vehicle that could go anywhere and I left see. The rest up to Ornas.
And it had, so has to be powered by more hay. Than,
yeah. Yeah. That's
right. It's got a place.
When people got plenty, it's got a poop. For the crops.
Powered
no,
by-
but it, like essentially there it's... The horse could go anywhere. You didn't need a road. Gotcha. Yeah. So
that makes sense.
Replace the horse. With.
Powered by a 2.5-liter four-cylinder engine that gave it 93 horsepower and 135 foot-pounds of torque, the Scout was priced to move at $2,128.84, roughly $22,444.
So basically a Impreza, base Impreza.
This value proposition, you guys both had Imprezas.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up and looked at Bart. Yeah.
Oh.
But you had a Sport.
I had the Sport hatchback. Was yours a hatchback?
Yeah.
Hatch, yeah.
I got the base model, and then I got really bummed out by how many, like...
Quarts of oil it would eat?
No. you know, like, when you don't get an option and you just get a blank plate over it? There were so many spots
That's
that,
hilarious.
Yeah, I was like, oh,
it
man,
just
what?
Kept reminding
yeah.
me.
I was like, I wonder what that would have done.
Maybe heated my butt. So cold.
So this value proposition was aided by a variety of body options. Its base model was a doorless and topless roadster. It was also available in a half cab pickup. You could add a soft top, a removable hard top, or a travel top, which covered the bed
I feel
of the
like
Scout.
This is the son of the guy who did the 142 different wheelbases. Yes.
hard top, soft top, half top,
travel top. In form and function, it resembled what we now call SUVs. Because it was initially planned as a pickup truck, the Scout had four-wheel drive as an option, but IH didn't anticipate this to be a very popular feature. Instead, they initially focused production on the Scout's two-wheel drive half-cab pickup truck version. But when more and more orders came in for the four-wheel drive with the full travel top configuration, production was shifted to accommodate the market.
It's cool that they understood to look at the market.
You know, almost like a business.
Yeah, well, some businesses, like, you have to beg for stuff. And they finally start making it after, enough. Like, 20 years.
Yeah, like everyone's like, please design something to replace the horse.
We need this. 50 years now. We've been-
up, Up to that point, the only four-wheel drive recreation vehicle was the CJ Jeep. But the Scout 80 would bring 4x4 capability to a larger vehicle, adding more storage, more horsepower, and better creature comforts. It would be a vehicle that could be endlessly customized for camping, farm work, and commuting. When just how customizable was it? Advertisements touted the Scout as a, quote, someone do a New Atlantic.
A quick change, artist. In minutes, you can make the Scout whatever kind of vehicle you want. It's a station wagon, a convertible, a light-duty hauler, a runabout. Like having four vehicles for the price of one. Is that what you're hoping for, North?
Perfect. Right. Nailed it.
Clearly, they were on to something.
I just sold me on that.
Clearly, International was on to something. Launched in January of 1961, the Scout 80 was an instant hit. A month into production, IH's Fort Wayne assembly plant had to add a second shift, and by the end of the year, they had produced 35,000 units, making it the hottest-selling vehicle in IH's history.
That's a quick run-up.
Throughout its production, the Scout 80 continued to add options like rear bench seats, bucket seats, a two-way radio, amongst other features that added increased...
That one weird seat from the tractors?
the pyramid-shaped seat that's for punishment?
These features added increased livability amid its utilitarian capabilities. By mid-1964, International Harvester was nearing a production milestone, 100,000 Scouts produced. And to celebrate, IH debuted the Red Carpet Series, the first ever luxury edition of the Scout. It added chrome bumpers, you had wheel covers, and as the name implied, it was the first Scout with a fully carpeted interior.
I used to say that the Nissan Murano Cross Cabriolet looked like a bathtub that like Huey, Louie, and Dewey would like cruise around in. Mm-hmm. This is the bathtub car.
Very bathtub like. A similar Champagne Series followed.
I like the way that's luxury, too. That's 50s luxury. Rockefellers driving around in the sky.
A similar Champagne Series followed in 1965. And decades before the Range Rovers and Escalades of today, IH was the leader in this nascent luxury segment. All told, International Harvester sold over 100,000 Scout 80s in roughly 5 years, far exceeding IH's internal projections. But, guys, SUV craze was just getting started.
What?
The success of the Scout caught the attention of the Ford Motor Company. Like Willis, Ford had also produced Jeeps for the war effort, and they had noticed the increasing popularity of recreational vehicles. Sensing a segment where it lacked, Ford started studying the Scout. In 1962, they surveyed Jeep and Scout owners and learned their most common complaints were, quote, poor comfort, ride, noise, and vibration qualities, as well as subpar size and power.
I mean, yeah, it's an inline four. Mm-hmm. Not like the Jeep was super powerful.
It wasn't, yeah.
But if you have the Harvester is a bigger vehicle than the Jeep, so.
Well, for what it was, you know, like, it did its job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why, but then I think you start getting spoiled once you see all the other cars that are getting cranked out in the 60s especially.
They misunderstood then, the assignment and they made it exactly as powerful as one horse.
Yeah. No, you said replace a horse. Yeah. I thought you said a horse.
In 1965, this market research led to the creation of the Ford Bronco. And while the Scout had sold well against the CJ Jeep, this was its first purposely built competition. Some gin. Taking the Scout head on, Ford Broncos came standard with four-wheel drive, an inline six-cylinder engine, and just a few months into production, a V8 option.
There we go.
Ford was now armed with a Scout killer with more amenities, more standard features, and twice the cylinders. The massive Ford Motor Company entering a vehicle segment against a small-time player like International Harvester filled its executives with existential dread.
The Harvester executives.
Yeah, not the Ford executives. They were probably chilling. They're probably taking picnics and throwing out all their trash.
Yeah. Oh, like, we don't need these.
Feeling this existential dread, the Scout needed an upgrade, and it got one in the form of 1966's Scout 800. Building upon the success of the original Scout, it came with the option of a bigger four-cylinder engine, an inline six-cylinder, and eventually a V8. Both the Red Carpet and Champagne series served as transitional steps as the Scout 800 came with more polished interior options.
Was International Harvester making their own V8s?
That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Because, I mean,
we'll never
I feel
know.
Like that's a lot for, if you're coming from just doing inlines.
Yeah.
Developing a whole new forever.
Engine. Yeah.
Yeah.
A Dana 44 axle. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
That's cool.
That's cool.
All right, that's cool.
That's cool. Dude, time for a four axle and a rear axle. Dang, man. That's crazy.
Dang.
The inline fours were made by International Harvester. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There is a six-cylinder one.
That one would probably be just a longer version of their inline four.
Yeah. And then the V8. So
they made their own V8?
They made their own V8.
That's okay. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's cool, dude.
By the end of the 1960s, International Harvester had basically created a new market segment. It was now competing against not just the Bronco, but beginning in 1969, the Chevy Blazer as well. Fortunately, Ford had not given Bronco quite the marketing push as its other vehicles. And while the Bronco did make a dent in Scout sales, it remained a small side project for Ford, with the first-generation Bronco crossing 25,000 in sales just once. Still, with increased competition from Ford and Chevy, International Harvester was ready to greet the 1970s with its next generation of Scout. Hell yeah. The Scout 2, which is, I think, what Simonini had, debuted in 1971.
It's a good looking.
It's awesome. I love the high belt line and the chopped looking top. It's just like so iconic.
Chop that top.
I mean, it's clearly an answer to the Bronco.
Yes.
It's like...
It increased the size of the Scout and its the amount of engines you could get. And on the top end, there were two V8 options, a 304 cubic inch V8, and finally... a big 345 cubic inch V8 that beat Ford and tied GM for maximum cubic engines in the 4x4 SUV segment. And while these engine options kept pace with the competition, its modern amenities continued to put it well ahead of the curve with improvements in ride quality and the addition of power steering and air conditioning.
Nice. So they're giving the people some creature comforts.
It's interesting, too, because had the Bronco not come out, thanks to Ford's research, the Harvester probably wouldn't have had to make those adaptations.
Probably not. These advancements would continue when in the mid-70s, IH ended production of its suburban fighter, the Travelall, and in 1976 introduced two Scout models to fill the void. The Scout 2 Terra, which was a four-wheel drive pickup, and the Scout 2 Traveler. These two luxury models featured deluxe interiors and a hatchback on the Traveler. That's sick. Oh, dude. Yeah. Two-door SUV with a hard top. That is sick.
Yep. That is.
Dude, if you drove one of those down Abbot Kinney on a Saturday, you're the coolest guy on that particular street.
You're going to Lemonade.
Oh, you're going to Lemonade. No, what's that
salads.
One? What is that? There's that restaurant
Tender
on.
Greens?
Not Tender Greens.
Oh, you mean the it's Starred, right?
Yeah, it's like bougie as hell. You go in there.
It's on Abbot Kinney.
It's what on Abbot Kinney. The music's super loud. The food, the serving sizes are tiny. It's decent, but everyone there looks like they're
there's that little outdoor Instagram patio model space. Or
and you pull up to the parking lot, and they say, "Right here, sir."
Yeah, you're like, "I work in crypto, and I have a Scout Traveler." Yeah.
I dabble in pharma.
I dabble in pharma.
That just means you use drugs.
I dabble in pharma.
I invest in pharma.
I'm in deep. Yeah. In pharma.
I'm a creative director. I'm an artist, creative director. I dabble in crypto and pharma. Give me a table. I want to pay extra for these deviled eggs.
The surfboard.
Dude, deviled eggs are the new. They are the new scam right now. I paid $18 for two split in half quail eggs.
Quail eggs.
Those are tiny.
So they were tiny. And they had a little bit of maybe caviar or roe on top. And
damn.
I was like, a little fennel. And it's like, come on.
Hey, you can get those at the Japanese market has quail eggs for pretty cheap.
This was a good restaurant, though. I don't mean to talk smack, but man, what a racket.
For $18.
Yeah.
Sheesh.
I like deviled eggs.
Yeah,
I
so good.
Any holiday, if there's deviled eggs out, you can find me right by that platter.
Just by that tray.
Yep. You like them?
Yep. Hey, what happened to all the devil's eggs? You know, that's how it goes with me.
Your cheeks.
It's time to keep the lights on, so we'll be right back after this message.
What distinguished the Traveler was an additional 18 inches of wheelbase. They love that wheelbase, man. Yeah. And it took the Scout 2 from a
the grandson. Now it's the grandson. Like, what about wheelbase?
We can try that.
We'll try.
We've always got wheelbase. It took the Scout 2 from a compact SUV to the earliest of the soccer mom mobiles. It had ample storage space, so the hatchback.
I'll tell you what, if there's a soccer mom driving that, like that's she's a cool, cool she's soccer cool. mom.
That's yeah. cool as hell. She's probably listening to the
got
Offspring.
Bag of balls in the back, you know, mesh bag of balls for the kids.
Yep. It had ample storage space with a hatchback or like a liftgate, like when you know, sure. camper shell kind of deal.
Yeah.
This variant took up Four Wheel Magazine's Four Wheeler of the Year, and with it. The Scout seemingly reached its final form as the granddaddy of all family-style SUVs on the market.
So this is like
so that's it, and the rest. It's
and
all.
And then
it's
they
all
did great business
roses
after
that.
That.
It's
right.
International.
Please tell me they
the
did all
market
right.
cornering.
That
international
is so cool. The Traveler is sick. I like that. I like that. That right there.
Yeah, I think like I'm that. Gonna like that.
I think I'll take a blue. Traveler. The Blues Traveler.
The Blues Traveler.
I'll take that.
Yeah, it comes in. John Popper comes with the car and like raps. You're like, what? When it seemed like the Scout was on top of the world, things are about to come crashing down. In a shockingly short amount of time, IH's iconic vehicles would become a footnote in automotive history, and International Harvester wouldn't be far behind. Ironically, the seeds, because farming, of the decline were planted, also because farming.
It's the same metaphor, Nolan. You don't have
Damn
to keep
it.
Doing
The seeds of the decline were planted with the Scout's groundbreaking development.
Groundbreaking because of farming.
Because they got a till.
Groundbreaking development of a light-duty truck that could be anything to anyone. Truck owners were no longer buying based on towing and payload specs, but looking for vehicles that could serve as any other family car. So they began looking for their next truck at car dealerships, not the heavy-duty truck and farm equipment dealers that carried International Harvester vehicles. Oh. This meant that despite the success of the Scout, IH lost market share during the 60s.
Yeah, you don't want to have to drive out to Avenue 297 to go buy a car.
It is weird to think about, though, one company selling the farm equipment and trucks and just having them all at the same spot.
I'm thinking about that'd be kind of like if you had to go to a John Deere dealership.
Or Home Depot.
Or Home Depot.
You're going to go to Home Depot.
To get a car.
There's like,
That'd be crazy.
Lawnmower, tractor, truck. I'll try this.
Pretty interesting.
You might get some impulse buys though. Like, I'll get a grill. I'm going to get a grill, but I might as well get it.
How am I going to get it home?
Hey, that's where they get you. That's where they get you. The Big Three also had a massive economics of scale advantage. Their pickups shared much of their components with dozens of other vehicles they were already producing in the hundreds of thousands. Conversely, IH's light truck parts were shared with larger trucks that were produced at a much lower volume. And this contributed to International Harvester's perpetually low profit margins. The oil crisis of the mid-70s added yet another hurdle. When Congress enacted the first ever corporate average fuel economy standards, the Big Three had small sedans it could use to offset its money-making gas guzzlers because it exclusively produced trucks and SUVs. But because IH exclusively produced trucks and SUVs, meeting the MPG targets provided by the governments would always be an issue for International Harvester.
But they are held to a different standard than normal cars.
Yes.
Light trucks?
I think at the time the average was the actual average, and then the automakers lobbied to have trucks not apply, and that's why we're in the place we're at now. Because
and that's where we got the little red express.
Yes.
The Dodge.
Like,
yeah.
Stuff like that.
And then muscle trucks.
Muscle trucks. Another unique obstacle that International Harvester faced was being in three different capital-intensive industries. There's farm equipment, construction equipment, and automobiles. IH simply didn't make enough money to sufficiently fund their myriad of expensive product lines and offerings. Its better resource competitors like John Deere, Caterpillar, and the Big Three were able to invest in their products in a way that IH just couldn't.
Because they're each only making one product.
Mm-hmm.
Right. In the 1970s, IH took the somewhat radical step of bringing in an outsider to run the company. Xerox president Archie McCardle.
Hey, what's everybody else doing? Let's copy that. It's worked for me so far. Just copy it.
He went to work immediately, investing heavily in new products and technology, saddling IH with even more debt. To counter this spending, McCardle attempted to get concessions from the United Auto Workers. The UAW balked at McCardle's requests, partially owing to recent large bonuses paid out to all non-hourly workers at IH, and went on strike for 5 months. This resulted in the company losing nearly $500 million in 1979.
That's a good thing, though, that the corporate greed ended there in 1979. Yeah. Learned their lesson, huh?
Yeah, everything just kept getting more regulated into the next decade.
It's good. Greed is bad.
I got a hot take. Greed?
Making matters worse.
You guys are paying me, right?
I mean, I'm not.
I thought you were doing this out of the kindness of your heart.
I'm a very kind person.
I got enough kindness in here. Give me some money. Making matters worse, at the same time, the economy was slowing and interest rates were rising. Despite this, management kept up production on farm equipment, incorrectly assuming that dealers would be rushing to place orders once the strike ended. This misplaced optimism was further blunted in January of 1980 when the U.S. imposed a grain embargo on the Soviet Union in response to their invasion of Afghanistan. This hit grain farmers hard and left International Harvester with scores of unsold farm equipment. Ultimately, International Harvester's way to deal with its problems was to accumulate and carry a massive debt burden, which, combined with poor management, unsustainable.
Interest rates were like what, 15, 16 then? That's 79.
Pretty high, yeah. So,
yeah. That's like, so it's unreal. Like, why would you take out a bunch of debt?
That's Archie for you.
That's right.
Archie.
In 1985, International Harvester sold their farm equipment business to longtime rival J.I. Case, but retained their truck and engine business under the name Navistar International. Its automotive legacy continued as Navistar actually produced a diesel V8 engine ironically sold in Ford trucks until 2010. I've heard of Navistar.
Yeah.
What the heck? Whoa.
So they got out of the vehicle biz and just kept making motors.
This was seemingly the end of International Harvester and the Scout. Or so we thought. In 2021, Volkswagen purchased Navistar International and 1 year later announced the rebirth of the Scout as an all-electric SUV and...
Just what everyone was hoping for.
And an all-electric pickup truck model.
I do think he's going to be sick, though. They just had a huge 900-mile off-road convoy that ended at the factory.
Where they're breaking ground at the new factory, yeah.
But I think if VW lends their platform to it or lends their technology, I think it'll be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Not merely another Volkswagen, the Scout will be relaunched as a standalone brand, producing vehicles focused entirely on the U.S. market. It aims to play up its cult status, Midwest bona fides, and off-roading history.
Let me just sneak past you there.
A $2 billion factory is currently under construction in South Carolina with a planned production output of 250,000 vehicles a year. Good Lord. The all-new Scout vehicles are expected to arrive in 2026 when they'll compete with the Tesla Model Y, the Ford Mach-E, and Rivian's R2, which is also primed for a 2026 debut.
I gotta say, I'm a little bit more excited for that R2.
So, despite inventing the modern SUV with the Scout, and not to mention the first pickup, International Harvester went from a 20th century American corporate monolith to IP designed to buttress the off-roading ambitions of the Volkswagen Group. Ironically, by killing the Scout in an attempt to save the company, International Harvester got out of the market it created right before it really blew up in popularity. But to this day, Scout enthusiasts still evangelize about the vehicles years later, in which all sorts of upgrades and options now common to SUVs were available well ahead of their time. While still largely forgotten, the recent successful relaunch of the Ford Bronco, as well as the ever-climbing sales of large luxury family haulers, firmly place International Harvester's fingerprints all over American culture. And with its pending electric rebirth, the Scout could ride yet again as an innovator in recreational vehicles once more and create another vehicle segment altogether.
The Scout walked so the Pontiac Aztec could run.
That's right. That There you go. There you go.
Bart, does this make you want to
buy an Aztec? No, I think it's a cool. I mean, it's one of those vehicles that no matter who you are, when you see it, you're like,
that's really cool.
That's cool.
That thing's awesome.
I love the Traveler, man.
Not many cars have that.
No.
I wish I could drive down Abbot Kenny with my Scout Traveler.
Right this way, Mr. Sykes. No, here's your devil quail eggs.
Your devil quail eggs on Abbot Kenny.
Heck yeah.
Well, cool. We have some listener mail this week. This is from Luke from Manchester.
New Hampshire?
England. Luke says, hello to everyone at Donut. I've been watching you guys since the
accent. I'm just kidding.
Hello, everyone at Donut.
Sorry, Luke.
I've been watching you guys since the start of Money Pit. It's been an honor to watch all your content and see you all bloom into such amazing and talented people.
Damn, thank you.
Thank you for everything you make and do. That really touches us right now in a time of transition when we're trying our best to.
Yeah, thank you. And you spelled honor with a U in there, so that's how we know you're
over
there. Love
those extra letters. Yeah. After re-listening to Dan Gurney episode on the journey to uni one day, uni is what they call
post-secondary middle education.
I decided to research the Gurney flat further for my final year dissertation.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
My paper was titled Using Computational Fluid Dynamics to Study the Effect of Gurney Flap Design on the Aerodynamic Performance of Race Cars' Wings.
Wow, okay.
And the Past Gas podcast got a small acknowledgement at the end, thanking you for the idea.
Hey, thank you for thanking us.
For citing us. My last year of uni was a big improvement both in terms of grades and social life, and I'm glad to say it ended on a high.
Yeah.
By the time you're reading this, I will have graduated with a first on my dissertation. I don't know what that means.
Don't know either. Some
sort probably of like good. An A? It's probably good, yeah.
If it's good, yes. If it's bad,
better
whoever
luck
gave
next
you that
time.
First blows, dude. I can't thank you all enough for your hard work and commitment. Luke from Manchester, England. Well, thank you, Luke.
Dude, thank you, Luke. That's awesome. Congratulations on the dissertation.
Yeah.
Thank you, Luke. And if you'd like to send us an email, not Luke, someone, if
Luke, you can keep emailing.
You
can
just do it.
But you can also, if you are not Luke and would like to send us an email, hit us up at passgas@donutmedia.com.
But also, if you're Luke, you can still email.
Send us some, let's hear about that social life a little bit. Let's dig in a little bit. passgas@donutmedia.com. Bart, thank you so much for coming, dude.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Yeah, dude, that was
it's
really
always
fun.
Good to hang out with you.
Yeah,
you
it's been too long.
Well, we just had lunch a couple weeks ago.
Well, don't talk about that, dude.
Dude, we don't like to talk about our lunch here. Okay?
Oh, we're getting lunch.
That's right. We've got to eat lunch now. Okay, so thank you guys so much for listening and watching. However you're taking in the show, I love doing this, and we will see you next time. Big thank you to the crew, Gavin Kinzel, Nick Giamuso, Audrey Holden, and our writer this week, Jordan Pomaville. Thank you very much, and we will see y'all next time.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye. So then,
see you later.
So long.